Joshua Cheney Guimond was a 20-year-old student at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. On the night of November 9, 2002, he was playing cards with his friends in their room. Around 11 p.m., he left, his friends thinking he went back to his own dorm. He was never seen again. I'm Ed Densel, and this is Unfound. If I were to tell you there was a college out there that suffered a sex abuse scandal? What if I were to also tell you that this scandal went up to and included the football coach? In addition, what if I told you that the students and the alumni of this college were in total denial about the entire thing? I know what you'd be thinking. You'd be thinking of Penn State. You'd be thinking of Joe Paterno. You'd be thinking of Jerry Sandusky. You'd, of course, be thinking about the victims of Jerry Sandusky. Then finally, you'd be thinking about all of those students at Penn State currently and all the other students who went there and graduated, who to this day defend Joe Paterno and say that he didn't know anything about the scandal that happened for so many years on that campus. But I'm here to tell you that's not what I'm talking about in this show. In fact, you're going to hear about a sex abuse scandal that is much worse than what happened at Penn State. In fact, they're really not even close. In Penn State's case, there was only one sex abuser, Jerry Sandusky. Granted, other people covered up for him, but there was just one, and now he's in jail. But the story you're going to hear today involves multiple abusers and hundreds of victims. And a lot of those abusers are still walking around free men. At least you can say in Jerry Sandusky's case, he's behind bars. You're probably wondering, what college is this? Well, it just happens to be the school where Joshua Guimond disappeared from, St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. In fact, by the time Joshua enrolled as a freshman at St. John's University, the scandals involving sex abuse on that campus had already been decades old, going back to the 1960s. And once again, I'm sure you're asking yourself, why haven't you heard about it? Well, I'm very fortunate to have on the show today a man who has been covering this sex abuse scandal. And, well, I'll just let him tell his own story regarding all of it. I'm calling this episode Joshua Guimond in the Center of a Scandal. And now the facts of the case. This is a condensed version of what you'd be able to find at the Charlie Project. Joshua Guimond was a junior at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota, majoring in political science. He had many friends, always looking to help them if they got into jams. His family has said Joshua hoped to have a future in law and politics. On November 9th, 2002, he was at the Matincourt dormitory playing cards with friends. Around 11 p.m., he left the room, his friends thinking he was going to the bathroom. When he didn't return in a few minutes, they guessed he returned to his own dorm, St. Mar House, on the other side of the lake that sits on the St. John's campus. They called his dorm, but there was no answer. They thought he had gone to bed. The next day, his friends couldn't find Josh, and it was at this time they realized he had never reached his dorm the night before. In addition, his car on campus didn't look like it had been used. His glasses, contact lenses, and credit cards were all left behind. Over the days and weeks, the campus lakes were searched by divers, and the buildings were searched by dogs. Although there were some hits by the dogs at various locations, no signs of Josh or anything he had with him that night were found. Josh's family believes he met with foul play, with the focus being some research Josh was doing at the time regarding St. John's and its scandalous history. If anyone has any information concerning the disappearance of Joshua Guimond, please contact the Stearns County Sheriff's Department at 320-259-3700. Just a few comments I'd like to make before you get to listen to the interview that goes along with this episode. The number of abusers and victims in this story are staggering. They're almost to the point of being unbelievable. And I say that from personal experience because that's the way I felt when I first started to learn about all of this. You also need to understand, and this is brought up in the interview, that it continues to this day. Also, you also have to understand that people disappearing because they, quote unquote, knew something are rare. Maybe there might be some mafia stories regarding that, but once again, people who disappear or are murdered, let's say, because they knew something, in the wide world of missing persons in the United States, those cases are very, very small. So I want you to keep that in mind. You will have to make up your own mind whether Josh's disappearance had anything to do with what you're going to find out went on at St. John's University for all these decades. And as is usually the case, after this interview, I will offer up some other possibilities as to what could have happened to Josh. Now, my interview is with Patrick Marker. He is the owner and content provider for BehindThePineCurtain.com, a blog that has been covering St. John's University, the sex abuse scandals, and Joshua's disappearance for many years. And like I said before, I'll just let him tell his own story. I give you now my interview with Patrick Marker. I'm very happy to have on the show right now Patrick Marker of the website BehindThePineCurtain.com. Patrick, thank you for joining me.
I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show. There's so much to talk about when it comes to this subject matter, and I think the more we can get the word out via any avenue, any channel is important, so I appreciate you having me on.
You're welcome. I've portrayed this case as a disappearance being intertwined with a conspiracy that goes, it's a huge one, but it's also kind of an unknown one. I'd like you to talk about yourself and how you became involved in what has gone on at St. John's University over the past decades.
Well, it was actually 25 years and 1 month ago that my case was made public in the media, the case of sexual abuse by a monk at the prep school on campus at St. John's University in Collegeville, Minnesota. The campus of Collegeville includes not only St. John's University, St. John's Prep School, it also is the home to what once was the largest Benedictine monastery, I believe, in the world, certainly in North America, St. John's Abbey. It also includes an ecumenical center and the liturgical press, a large printing outfit on campus. So there's a lot going on campus there in Collegeville. They have their own post office. They have their own fire department. They have their own incinerator and garbage plant. They have their own solar farm. Most anything you need, you can get on campus and within that community. And it's been a tight-knit community of monks primarily, but then those who were educators and students for decades, for over 100 years, well over 100 years.
Hmm.
And so for 25 years ago and 1 month ago, back in August of 1991, I decided that it was time to tell my story and kind of break the seal of secrecy that has been surrounding and over that town of Collegeville for decades. I know that based on news reports that came out back in 91, that there were reports of misconduct in 1933. There was a murder about the same time on campus of a monk, killing another monk. And this, you know, whether it be abuse or misconduct, in one case murder, have been stories of evil and darkness, mm-hmm. you know, for at least the last 80 years. When my family used to take our summer, in the mid-70s, before we moved to Minnesota from the Seattle area, we actually spent the summers, several summers in the late 70s, on the campus of St. John's University. And
how did that come about? How did that come about that from Washington to Minnesota?
My parents were very good Catholics. In fact, from the time I can remember, certainly my first communion until my first part of my freshman year in college, I missed 2 Sundays of Mass. I was sick on one occasion, and we were at Yellowstone National Park on one occasion. And I took pride in the fact that I'd missed only 2 Sundays my entire life going to church. But I've more than made up for it because we would go, I was a Catholic student from age 5 until I graduated from high school. We went to Mass sometimes daily, certainly in the grades 5, 6, 7, and 8. It was a daily thing mm-hmm. that we just did. And so my parents were very Catholic, and they'd gotten very involved with the natural family planning and the marriage encounter weekends. And they heard about these conferences that were going on at St. John's University. And they, I don't know if they were asked to participate, but they did participate in these, the Human Life Center, it was called. And the Human Life Center was run by a monk, Father Paul Marx. And my parents got to know him, and they got to know the Human Life Center staff through these conferences that would go on for 2 weeks, I believe, each summer. And so in 1976 and 77 and 78, we went out to St. John's for the 2 weeks. And in 79, the conferences were held in the San Francisco area, so we went there. And then back in 1980, we went back to St. John's, and my parents took part in the Human Life Center conferences. Well, the kids, there were 5 of us at the time, mm-hmm. we walked the campus, enjoyed the campus, went swimming, caught fish, went to the library. And one of our favorite things to do was to go to the library and watch a video mm-hmm. about the ghosts of St. John's, about the cracks in the churches, and about the chapel out on the lake that were scary. And it was this old videotape that we would rent, and we probably rented it every one of our trips out there, or viewed it anyway. But there was always this, it was interesting now looking back, that back in the mid-70s, we were going to St. John's as kids, and the things that we would do, we were very interested, at least I was anyway, in watching this tape, and we're all scared of these mm-hmm. ghosts of St. John's. And then years later, they became real ghosts.
Real ghosts. St. John's. Yeah, that's an excellent point, yes.
Yeah. So in the summer of 1981, my parents were offered the job. They were offered the job of directing the Human Life Center, taking over for Father Paul Marx. And so we moved from Seattle area out to Minnesota. And I ended up attending school on campus at St. John's Prep School. It was then a school for grades 9 through 12, and now it's a school for 6 through 12.
Mm-hmm.
So I started school and was very homesick, and I'd grown up in the Seattle area. The first time I went to a football game, I remember, was with a priest. A different priest taught me how to drive. I cut grass for a third priest. Priests were at our house often, if not every week. I mean, we had the Archbishop from Seattle at our house. It was just something that we were very comfortable, and we were, you know, good Catholics, mm-hmm. probably above average Catholics, I guess. And so, you know, when a priest said, "Hey, I notice you're not fitting in here, or I'd like to talk to you. You seem to be having some problems adjusting. I welcome the opportunity for this man to listen and to perhaps provide some answers and some help and support.
Yeah. Yes.
And for a long time he did that. And then at some point it took a turn that was less than therapeutic and less than beneficial to me, and started a spiral of misconduct and finally sexual abuse that was devastating. It was so devastating, in fact, that I don't recall thinking about it for 6 years. I know it affected me because I've realized some of the things that I did in college, and I've spoken with people that I went to college with and after college. So I know it affected me. Mm-hmm. The abuse itself ended in 1983. It wasn't until 1989 that I actually realized what had happened through a series of nightmares and flashbacks. And I actually, here's where I have to thank my perpetrator. I actually thank my perpetrator because he could have easily said to me, Pat, I never did that. But, and those people who say, you know, repressed memory and, you know, those type of things aren't real. In my case, I don't know that it was a repressed memory, but I don't recall ever thinking about it. But when I did have to start dealing with it, the first phone call I made was to the priest, and I said, hey, I've got some issues here, and I need some help. And he admitted what he did, or at least validated what I did, and he apologized. But then he told me, and this was 1989, he told me that what he had done certainly was wrong, but he asked me, I'm not even say that he asked me, he expressed a concern that if he told his superiors what he did to me, that he would get kicked out of the monastery, he felt, because it had happened again. And I thought, at the time, I thought, oh, geez, I can't do anything with this. I don't want him to get kicked out of the monastery. It didn't register in my mind that what he was telling me was that he had other victims.
Right. Right. And that's exactly what he was saying. Right.
Exactly. And I didn't do anything with it. He said, I said, listen, I told him I'd gone through counseling. It was only because I had gone through counseling that I had the strength to call him. I was actually lying to him. I needed counseling badly, and I ended up getting counseling later. But I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I didn't want to hurt him. So I said, listen, I'm better. It's okay. But I just need help paying for it. He said, well, I can't help you pay for it because if they know what happened to somebody else, they'll kick me out.
So the monastery already knew that this priest had done something to somebody else.
Right.
But then yours would be the second or third or fifth or tenth or whatever, and that would be enough to kick him out. Once wasn't enough. It would take two or more or something.
Right.
That's very strange.
Right. Well, as you'll learn as we speak along and continue along here, it wasn't.
Right.
It's actually par for the course, and there are some people who are four, five, six times accused before finally something happens to them.
Yes, the listeners are definitely going to get an earful. Yes, yes, absolutely.
So I first contacted him in 1989, and then didn't do anything with it for a while. And then the flashbacks continued. The problems with the relationships continued. And I thought, you know what, it's time to do something about this. And I remember being at a teaching conference. I was teaching at the time in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And I was at a conference later in the summer before the school year was to start. And I remember I was at the conference with my friend Mark, and we were eating, I believe, at a Perkins restaurant. And I picked up the USA Today newspaper, and I read a report about, a meeting of bishops somewhere in the United States. And they talked about the prevalence, about the numbers involved with sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And this was
1989, which is still several years before the really huge blow up in the Catholic Church in the United States?
I believe it was the summer of 1990. So I sat on this for a year. I'd made the phone call, didn't want to do anything to rock the boat in this priest's world, kind of was trying to help him out. And then I believe it was the summer of 1990 that I was at this conference and read the newspaper, saw the numbers, and thought, wow, I need to do something about this. This is, I can't sit on this because this means that other people are going to have issues and are going to try to solve these problems on their own that really aren't their problems to solve. They need help just like I need help. And so I did something that was, you know, I took the first step. I dialed 1-800-LAWYERS because I'd seen a billboard or a phone book or something. I didn't know who to call. I dialed 1-800-LAWYERS, and I got in touch with this lawyer named Bob. And Bob and I met on a couple of occasions, and he said, "Listen, this is too big for me. This isn't something that I do." And so he put me in touch with a lawyer that he knew of by the name of Jeff Anderson. And that was, I believe, in the summer of 1990. And then in the August of 1991, my lawsuit was filed.
How old were you at the time? The filing of this lawsuit, how old were you at the time?
I would have been 26.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if that was the beginning of the beginning of the beginning of the middle, but I can tell you that the 90% of my motivation for what I've done over the past 25 years came from a comment that Father Dan Ward, lawyer for St. John's and St. John's monks at the time, he himself was a monk, but he was also a canon lawyer. And he represented some of the monks. He represented my perpetrator. And he stood on the steps of the Abbey Church being interviewed by a reporter. And he said that St. John's would deny all of these allegations. They didn't want to play it out in the media. They you know, let things take their course. But the fact that he was willing, after my perpetrator said to me, that he was sorry, and that, yeah, what he did to me was wrong, but that he couldn't help me. And then this man to stand up and announce to the public that they denied the allegations.
So essentially calling you a liar.
Essentially calling me a liar. That was a turning point for me. I mean, that was a scary day. At that point, I was still John Doe. They didn't show my face. They showed the back of my head. And I was on camera for a bit, and I told a little bit of my story, and it was shared on the news, and all of a sudden I was this John Doe, and nobody knew who I was. And to have this man then say, you know, what this man is saying is not true, you know, that motivated me.
Yeah, I bet
and
it would.
It motivated me to find out what other secrets were they hiding. So August of 1991 was the first step in me deciding it was time to learn the truth about St. John's. And so this 25-year journey has led me to a lot of truths. It's led me through many lies. It's led me through a lot of dark stories. This weekend when I was in Minnesota, I was explaining to some friends of mine that I tell people that I've spoken with over 200 victims of misconduct at St. John's. And because I trust these people and they know me, I backed up and I said, you know what? I've got to tell you the truth. I tell people it's 200 because I know that if I tell them the truth, they won't believe that it's almost, it is unbelievable. If I tell people that over the last 25 years, I've spoken with 300 victims of misconduct, it's almost too big for them to wrap their arms around, and they think, oh, he must be lying.
Yeah.
And unless you're involved with victims of sexual abuse and misconduct, unless you understand the dynamics and the realities at St. John's, 300 is impossible. 200 is ridiculous.
Yeah.
But then you do the math and you realize that just a few years ago, St. John's had on their website, they said there have been 23 men who have been credibly accused of misconduct. Well, 23 perpetrators. You would ask most abuse support groups, advocates. You say, well, if a perpetrator's name is made public, the average number of victims they have is how many? And the number is usually 10. And we know that Finian MacDonald, one of the monks at St. John's, is also a priest, but he's a monk from St. John's.
Mm-hmm.
He admitted to having over 200 sexual encounters, different people, many of them minors.
So, all from the prep school that you...
Most of them from his overseas travel.
Okay.
But he had many victims at St. John's University and many victims from St. John's prep school. And probably, you know, there are other things that happened on campus. There were leadership camps, music camps, the boys' choir, all sorts of retreats. And just the number of people who went through that campus, stayed on campus, lived on campus, worked on campus. It was a, you know, taking from a 1980s movie, I think, it was a target-rich environment for perpetrators.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so going back to the numbers, though, if you – St. John's on their website admitted to 23 perpetrators. Well, if you take even the small – you know, the average number of 10 perpetrators per, or 10 victims for a perpetrator, you get to 230 right there. Well, I know for a fact that I've spoken with over a dozen victims of my own perpetrator. I've spoken with over a dozen victims of several other perpetrators.
So a dozen each. When you say a dozen, you don't mean dozen over 12 dozen per one perpetrator.
And I'm going to go back on that. I'm going to go back on my perpetrator, and I'm going to say that if you do the math regarding the average number of victims that a perpetrator has, and you look at what the St. John's had published on their website a few years ago, before they took it down, of course, that they had 23 perpetrators who had been part of their community. Well, if your average perpetrator has 10 victims, then you're up over 200 victims already. But we know from experience, my perpetrator and other perpetrators on campus, they had approaching a dozen or 15 or possibly 20 victims. So the numbers get high very quickly.
Yeah.
And St. John's, while they've admitted to having 23 perpetrators in their midst, my website makes it clear that that number is low. And I believe the number of perpetrators who has, or I believe that the number of perpetrators who have come through the St. John's system is approaching 100 now, whether it be monks on campus, whether it be visiting priests who have come to the School of Theology, whether it be lay people on campus, I talked about visiting monks. There were a couple of visiting monks who showed up to get an education, and they abused while they're on campus. It's like, how in the world do these people end up at St. John's? Certainly St. John's isn't the only place in the world where sex abuse was a problem.
Right.
But I would challenge anyone to find a concentrated community of offenders and in a place that was so attractive to other offenders with numbers higher than St. John's in Collegeville, Minnesota. And I challenge them and believe I will win that challenge, because I don't believe there's a higher concentration of sexual perpetrators than what I have discovered on that campus over the last several decades.
In fact, you could say that maybe that the reason that's the case is because the priests who were there were telling other ones to come there, probably.
The culture at St. John's has the culture at St. John's has not been and continues to not be healthy with regard to sexuality. And it's been that way for several decades. The type of person that was attracted to come to St. John's to become a monk and to study in the school of theology, that the type of person that was attracted here and was different.
Mm-hmm.
How to explain different? I can tell you this. Mm. While I've gone about my research over the last 25 years, I've spoken with hundreds of victims. I've spoken also with dozens of monks who left the monastery. And the reason they left is this, in almost every instance, is because they didn't want to be a part of the problem. They realized what was going on mm-hmm. on campus. They realized what was going on in the monastery. It wasn't Catholicism that was being taught at St. John's. It was this radical view of Christianity. It was a radical view of selfishness and what can the church do for me and what can I get as a member of the St. John's community. St. John's attracted a lot of well-intentioned men, and most of those men left. And the people that stayed behind were the weaker, the
I don't know, the more susceptible, the more controllable, the people that just wanted to go along with the program.
Yeah, the men who weren't strong enough to leave became mm-hmm. part of a system that compromised people, compromised their own community of monks, and then it compromised the community of believers, and then it compromised a population of young people through sexual abuse, misconduct, and control that has left a very black cloud that exists to this day over St. John's. And there are so many Johnny loyalists. They bleed Johnny red. And God bless them. Mm. It's fantastic to be loyal to a university and to a campus and to a cause. But when you turn a blind eye, when the St. John's says on their website that we have 23 credibly accused and nobody pays attention to it, or that there's lawsuit after lawsuit in the public eye and nobody pays attention to it, or one of the students disappears from campus
mm-hmm.
and it's treated as though somebody lost a key. You know, well, let's look for it for a few days and then let's pretend it didn't happen. And that's what's happened, is we're pretending that Joshua Guimond never disappeared. And that has to change. Attention needs to be paid to all of these things. Attention has to be paid to a campus and an environment that is toxic and that is just so debilitating. There are people, it's just amazing. I don't even know where to go with that. I mean, it's amazing the number of people who are loyal to St. John's but can't stand the place. Their parents work there. They work there. I mean, I've spoken with current employees who, this is what they do. Where else are they going to work? You know, if you work there, you get free tuition. So I can't blow the whistle. I can't stop donating. They'll know. In fact, if you go to my website, Behind the Pine Curtain, and somebody within the leadership finds out about it, you will have a consequence. I mean, there have been memos sent out about visiting the Behind the Pine Curtain website. You know, it's just, there's such this, there's a fear. You know,
the point is that it's just not, you know, for example, students said that they're there, but even afterwards, once they graduate, and even if they find out, even if they're there and they never even knew that all this sexual abuse has gone on for the last how many decades, they still remain loyal to St. John's University.
Well, and to an extent, they should remain loyal because that's their university. In fact, I've been accused several times of you know, picking on the university. When they say, well, it's not the university, it's the monks. And the monks were the university for a long time. And the monks are still part of the university. And these people who support the football team and support the basketball team and love the way the leaves turn in the fall and can't wait to come out. You know, it's a beautiful campus, but what people don't realize, and this is what I've been saying forever, there's so much deception and there have been so many lies told and there's been so much abuse on campus. If we were to have gone back to 1989 or 1991 when I came forward and started fixing this, or there was a major lawsuit settled in October, or a series of lawsuits that were settled in 2002, in October of 2002. There were more lawsuits settled in 2012. You know, take any one of those dates, 1991 or 2002 or 2013, at any point in there, we could have started telling the truth. We could have worked toward full disclosure. But instead, they've decided to try to hide the truth and try to cover up what's actually gone on there. And all they're doing is delaying the inevitable. I've said for years now that we must tell the truth, dig it up, and then bury it properly. And then we can move on. But because they're so afraid of telling the truth, because it is going to have some major ramification, because that means that their list of 23 is incorrect. My list of almost 100 is correct. And there's a lot of fallout that's going to come when they admit that the number is actually closer to 100 than it is to their 23. And they'd like the public to believe that it's a low number and that it's all been dealt with and that the perpetrators are on these safety plans and that they can't travel unless they're escorted and that there's really no issues and that nothing's happened in the last several years or sorry, nothing's happened in the last 20 years, they try to tell people. Discounting the fact that just a couple of years ago, one of the priests was credibly accused of misconduct on campus, and he, and this is within the last 5 years, he was removed from campus and was sent to Missouri, where the worst of the monk pedophiles, the priest pedophiles, actually go for treatment. And this is within the last 10 years this happened, I believe in the last 5 years. But they don't want to tell that truth because that truth brings consequences. And that's something that St. John's wants to avoid because they keep telling their constituents that it's in the past, it's in the past.
Why don't the American people know more about this? Given the even if it's just 23, which is still horrible, why don't the American people know about this? Is it because it's not, you know, to draw another example, Penn State, or because it's not a huge school, or is it because it's in Minnesota and not in California? What insight do you have on that? Because it's an incredible, disturbing story.
Well, there are other stories like it around the country, certainly, you know, Boston, number one. And it's just people don't want to hear the story. They don't, you don't, very rarely do you read a story like this and say, hey, I want more information about that, unless it happened to someone in the family or to you. So in a way, I would say to answer your question, all of those things. And in addition, people are burned out by it, and that's a sad truth that people have heard this story so many times that they don't want to hear it again. But when it affects family members and when it affects your community, you need to pay attention. There are so many secondary victims of these types of crimes, of this type of conduct and misconduct, that it is really affecting entire community, certainly the entire St. John's community, has been affected by it. And people will say, oh, everything's fine, it's in the past. But, you know, that's not true. And there's this, it would be nice if it was. And I'm all for that. I've offered my services many times to try to help clean things up on campus.
Mm-hmm.
One of the last times I was on campus was my 30-year class reunion back in 2013. I was excited to go there. I was so looking forward to this reunion and, you know, spending time with these classmates of mine I hadn't seen in 30 years. I contacted many of them as part of my research, but it was all discussion about abuse and misconduct. And rarely did we talk about, you know, the baseball team and school events. It was all focused on one thing. And certainly I hadn't spoken to them about my family or going salmon fishing or doing the things that I did as an adult. So I was looking forward to connecting with these classmates of mine. And so I went to the reunion and was sitting down at a table enjoying my lunch. I think there were seven other of my classmates there. And there were alumni from different years as well. So there was a good crowd out from the St. John's Prep School. And we were enjoying the lunch and had just listened to a presentation by one of the monks before the lunch. But there we were under the tents in the sun eating lunch, and I saw some security guards approaching. And I thought, well, this could be interesting because they were looking at me. And I thought, all right, well, let's see how this plays out. So one of the security guards came over to me and said, Mr. Marker. I said, yes. He said, you need to leave. You've been asked to leave campus. And I said, leave? I've just got here. You know, I'm having lunch. Go away. He says, no, you've been trespassed. You must leave. I said, wait a minute. I said, I have a ticket. And I showed him my ticket. And I said, I'm eating lunch. I'm going to finish my lunch. And then I will leave after that. He says, no, you'll need to leave right now. If you don't, I'll call the sheriff. And all right. Well, I said, call the sheriff. I would welcome that. And I'm going to get back to my lunch. So I continued eating my lunch, and the sheriff showed up. And as the sheriff walked over, the security guard for St. John's announced to the sheriff. I shouldn't say announced. He said loud enough to the rest of the people at the reunion to hear that I had a restraining order against me and I wasn't allowed on campus. And that was a lie, a complete lie. There had never been a restraining order placed on me, nor had I ever been trespassed by St. John's. But he made this announcement to the sheriff and to the people that within earshot that I had a restraining order. And the sheriff asked me to come over to his vehicle in the parking lot, and I did so. And the security guard again said that I had a restraining order. And the sheriff said that I would have to leave. So I said, okay, I would do that. And they asked where my car was. I said I didn't have one. I said that the person I came with, that they were still enjoying their lunch, and I didn't want to interrupt them. And so I walked off campus. And if you know the campus, the St. John's Prep School, where we were, is toward the back of the campus. And so I walked down the hill and in front of the Abbey Church and past the football field, and out I walked.
Wow.
And
you never, when you were going this never occurred to you that this might happen before you got there, especially considering your history with the school.
I've always been respectful of the people on campus, the jobs that they have to do. I've never interrupted a mass. I've never shouted something. I've never held up a sign. I've never protested. I realize that, you know, they have a job to do, and that's not in my best interest, and it's not the best way to get the word out.
Mm-hmm.
And for that day, the thing that I had been looking forward to was spending time with my classmates, and it never occurred to me that they would try to do this. I had a feeling the headmaster, the principal, if you will, the headmaster of the school, it didn't help that a month or so before that I had made public the fact that he had been credibly accused of misconduct.
Yeah, that wouldn't help.
Probably didn't help things.
Right.
But it was true. In fact, in 2003, I was on a review board with this gentleman, Father Jonathan Licari, and he was I was on a review board. And the goal of the mission of the review board was to help clean up the issue of sexual abuse on campus. And I was named to this review board. There were 9 members of the board, and after the 3rd meeting of this review board, we met every month. I flew from Seattle to Minnesota every month for 3 years. And after the 3rd month that we met in 2003, this priest, Jonathan Licari, was removed from the board. And he was removed from the board because of an incident of mixed conduct with an underage female at a parish, or while he was working at a parish in the Minneapolis area.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why he was removed from the review board. And then 10 years later, he gets a job as the headmaster at St. John's Prep School. And I wrote a letter to the abbot saying that that was a wholly inappropriate position for this man to be in, because the same people that he was going to be overseeing, they were the same age as his minor victim at the time he was removed from the review board. In addition, because there was a history of misconduct with Father Jonathan Licari, it would be devastating if another incident were to arise, because they would have had previous notice.
Right.
I suggested that it was suicide for the prep school to name this man as headmaster. But they went forward with it. And in fact, to this day, 3 years later, he remains headmaster at the prep school. And it's a ticking time bomb. I worry about the students at that school, and I worry about the community of St. John's with his position. So, and I believe, and have been told, but I believe that he was part of the effort to have me expelled from campus that day, and that it was a calculated, it was set up, that it was something that was planned, and it was, it was set in place before I even walked on campus that day.
Well, given all this, and we've got a nice setup for where we're about to go next, and that is, so Josh Gweeman shows up at St. John's University, and he disappears in 2002. What was he doing there? Do we know anything about, did he know about any of this when he became a student there? And then why is it that there are many people, myself, maybe yourself included, who think that all of this might have something to do with Joshua's disappearance? What might have made, what he him do, being there, what might have made him disappear on campus, possibly?
Well, Joshua Guimon was a student at St. John's University.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many possibilities of what could have happened to Josh. And we know that it wasn't just minors that the perpetrators on campus were attracted to. There's been a long history of misconduct by monks on campus with college students, a long history of it. And St. John's doesn't want people to know that history. In fact, they spent a lot of time early on. They listed the names of those monks who had been credibly accused of sexual misconduct with non-minors, with adults, with college students. But then as time went on, they realized that, hey, our numbers will go down if we just concentrate on the monks who were credibly accused of misconduct with minors. So they stopped talking about misconduct with college students. And there are more college, I believe, and I'd have to check my notes on it to my research, but I think there have been at least as many, if not more, college students victims of misconduct than minors on campus.
So we're talking about, when we say college students, we mean adults, 18 and over, inappropriate, right, but not technically illegal.
Right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So St. John's has really tried to press that that difference there. And that's, you know, that's just the way they've done their business, is that misconduct by a monk with a minor isn't as bad as sexual misconduct with a college student, which is just hogwash. But it's been in their favor and to their advantage to look at it as a legal issue than an ethical issue. And so that's always been the issue at St. John's.
But let's be clear about something, being that we're talking about Josh Gweeman. There's no evidence out there that he was ever abused by a monk, he ever had a relationship with anybody at the facility there, whether it's a male or a female. There's no allegations of that at all.
There are no allegations that he was a victim of misconduct. He certainly knew the population of monks. He had them as teachers. He had them as resident advisor or faculty residents living in his dorm. He was friends with one of the monks, Brother Willie, and I'm told that he was the night watchman on campus, officially or unofficially. That had been his role at one point, and he was one of the older guard, and that he, I'm told that he and Josh shared stories and got along quite well. But no, Josh was never targeted that I am aware of, nor a victim of it. Although he would have come across in just his day-to-day business several monk perpetrators, because they were still and are still on campus. And
still 14 years later, they're still there.
Still there, sure.
Okay.
And so he would have certainly been exposed to them, would have crossed paths with them, and so would have had interaction with some of the named perpetrators on campus.
And so what we also know that about Joshua is he was doing some sort of research paper into all of this.
According to his parents, yes, there was a research project that he was either interested in or had already begun on sexual abuse on campus, and not the abuse itself, but the cover-up, that he had been very frustrated. Josh was had a sense of justice about him. He knew right from wrong, and he was frustrated when people were treated unfairly. He represented, I'm told, his friends when his friends would come up, even when something went wrong that they were responsible for, he was there to assist them to help them work through their issues. He had I'm told he helped somebody get out of a speeding ticket, for instance. If they were accused of, if one of his friends was accused of something, he was kind of like the go-to guy. He was the in-house, unofficial lawyer for the group, where he would help people say the right thing or do the right thing in order to minimize the effect of what they had done, to minimize their sentence. So he was, he knew the system. He knew how to work the system. He tried to help as many people as he could.
But he didn't find out about what was going on at St. John's University until he got there. Right? I don't know who was paying for his education, but his parents or he didn't know about this until he got there, from all we know.
Oh, certainly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, and most people don't. Even there are people on campus right now who their parents who sent their students there. Some of these parents, I get emails all the time. I've been there for 3 years. I had no idea that this stuff is part of St. John's past. I mean, it's just amazing the emails that I receive. The people say, I had no idea. What can I do? I mean, this is mad. I mean, it doesn't make any sense for this long history. This fine institution to have this long history and yet nobody knows about it.
So yeah, that's why I asked you before about, how is it that a lot of people still don't know? And there's actually people going there that are just now finding out about it.
People were going there they're at school. It's now late September. They are on campus right now as a freshman, sophomore, junior, or senior. They don't know about the previous abuse. They don't know that they've already walked past two credibly accused perpetrators of sexual misconduct today. And by the time they graduate, they still may not know about it.
Wow. So we have Josh. He's doing this paper. Was he doing it for a class, or was he doing it on his own?
Well, again, I'm working only on what the family's told
yes,
me here.
I understand that.
He was working on it for a class, and that's as much as I know about that, that he was interested in by the amount of misconduct that had occurred on campus and that he was doing a paper on it.
And there are also allegations that somebody got into his computer after he left, after he disappeared.
Well, there are a couple points with that.
Yes.
First of all, there is evidence that after Joshua disappeared, items were erased from his hard drive. I think that's fairly well known and an established fact.
Okay.
Beyond that, there's, you know, there have been things found on his hard drive, fake IDs, people. So in 2010, I had access to Joshua Guimon's hard drive. By this time, the Stearns County Sheriff had already looked at it, and a professor from St. Cloud State University had access to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that I found when I ran some data recovery tools on it was a search that Joshua had performed, or whoever was using Josh's computer. And my understanding is that he used, when he was logged in under his name, that it was him using it. So I have every reason to believe that this was a Joshua Guimon search. And he searched for Abby Statute of Limitations Conspiracy.
Wow.
And this is in line with what the parents said he was doing his paper on.
Mm-hmm.
This date also coincides with a major settlement of sexual abuse claims made by, I believe, 12 victims against 11 different perpetrators on campus. So we've got this October of 2002 search that Joshua is performing. We've got this paper that he's said to be writing.
Mm-hmm.
We have a major settlement on campus.
Was that one of the, would you call that, being that you're the authority on this, would you call that a major milestone in what has gone on, you know, with all of these charges over the years? Was that October 2002, to me, sounds like a big deal.
It's a huge deal because St. John's took credit. Here's the thing. St. John's took credit in October of 2002 for doing the right thing. The abbot at the time, and he's still there as abbot, Abbot John Clausen, took credit for doing the right thing and finally addressing sexual abuse in a way that was fair, in a way that was compassionate, in a way that was honest. And this is what was sold by St. John's and others to the community, the St. John's community. And it was all a lie. It wasn't compassionate, it wasn't fair, and it wasn't honest. That this was the end of the story, really. It was being presented as the end of the story, that finally we had reached the end and that we could all start moving on. And one of the things that they did as a result of this large settlement was to name 8 people to a review board that, moving forward, would be in place to address all future claims of misconduct. It would really help the abbot clean up what was left of the filth at St. John's. And so it was hailed as this major achievement that would be duplicated and replicated around the country, if not the world, of how to handle sexual abuse in a compassionate, pastoral manner. And as time has passed since 2002, we've come to realize that that wasn't the end of anything, but it was merely just a continuation to the lies that had been told the whole time and continue to be told.
Right.
So did Joshua Guimon know more than the average student about sexual abuse and sexual misconduct on campus? I believe so. He had conversations, I'm told, with his parents about it. I'm told that he was writing a paper about it. I don't have evidence of that, but even without evidence of a paper, we still know that conversations were being had. And he had been speaking with monks on campus who he had developed friendships with. And so we know that he had an awareness. We also know that on the outside, St. John's was being presented as a model, but on the inside, there was much turmoil regarding this settlement in October of 2002 and the review board that was being named. And there were monks on campus who were furious with what decisions were being made for them and by the attorneys. Mm-hmm. And they wanted nothing to do with it. There were monks who threatened to quit the monastery because of this latest settlement, that the monk, that the abbot had overstepped his bounds, and that this wasn't the answer, and that their rights had been violated. So there were monks on campus who were furious.
With this October 2002 decision?
Correct.
Okay. And then a month later, Josh disappears. Out on a Saturday night, playing cards with his buddies, just ups and disappears. They think he's going back to his dorm, or they think he's going to the bathroom. They decide that he probably went back to his dorm, being that he doesn't come back, and then he's never been seen since. Were you happy? I mean, do you think that the search, we don't have to go into all the specifics and the days and everything, but do you think that there was an adequate enough search done on the St. John's campus after he disappeared?
Well, no, I don't. I mean, okay. I don't think there was an adequate enough search done on campus, or the investigation regarding his disappearance was handled appropriately. When the law enforcement calls back to the dorm room and asks for the password for a student's computer, I mean, in 2002, if you are a police investigator and you need a password to see what was happening on somebody's computer, you don't know much about computers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you just, first of all, there were missteps along the way. There were people who weren't interviewed. There were people that, there were things that were going on. And we know that Joshua's hard drive things were deleted from it, that it was whitewashed. I think that was the name of the program. But we know that his computer was used and tampered with the night he disappeared and into the following days. We knew that, everybody, I can't say everybody, there was evidence of fake IDs being made. There was, there were delays and,
I guess it's safe to say if somebody went to his computer and deleted stuff, obviously it wasn't the person who was involved with the fake ID stuff, because that stuff was still there.
Well, it was recovered.
It was recovered, yeah.
Yeah, I believe it was deleted, but it was recovered. Some of that stuff was
But very well could have been done by Josh himself at some point.
No, because it was done. A lot of the things that were deleted in the hours after he disappeared.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, in the days after he disappeared. So I think the thing that bothers me the most, especially more recently, is we've learned what was and wasn't done in the disappearance of Jacob Wetterling.
Right.
If you hold that same spotlight to law enforcement and you look at the Joshua Guimon disappearance, I think it's safe to say that, again, in hindsight being 2020, that mistakes were made and things that should have been done weren't done with regard to Joshua.
Now, what, just for the listeners, what Pat is talking about is that Jacob Wetterling's, the police that were investigating his original disappearance in 1989, is the same, coincidentally, the same police department that has investigated Josh Guiman's disappearance. Right?
So 1989, sorry, I'll do that again.
Right.
So in 1999, Jacob Wetterling disappears, and the law enforcement agency, one of them, in fact, and the first on the scene is the Stearns County Sheriff. And it's now well documented that mistakes were made in that investigation. And you would hope that, that they would have gotten better at their craft and that, that they would have some advances and some understanding of investigative techniques and what needed to be done when someone went missing. But now we're, you know, 13 years later in 2002, and Joshua Guimon disappears from campus. Mm. And, you know, as we've looked at who wasn't interviewed, who was, you know, which questions were asked, what happened with the hard drive, what happened with his personal belongings, and we examined who had access to him that night and who was interviewed with regard to his disappearance, I think that history will show at some point that mistakes, like in the Jacob Wetterling disappearance, mistakes were made. And I believe that when the case is examined and people are questioned, or even had they been questioned, that we would that there were pieces of this puzzle that were missed, and because they were missed, we may never solve the case. I mean, the public, few members of the public, very few members of the St. John's community, and I don't even think law enforcement is aware that the faculty resident at the housing area where Joshua was playing cards, and the faculty resident at the dorm where Joshua was heading, were both staffed by credibly accused monks. So you have Josh leaving a building, and that building, their faculty resident is a credibly accused monk. And he's going across campus, and he's going to show up at a place where he's lived for at least that year, and I believe the year before, but at least that year, he's in the presence and is being overseen by a monk who is also credibly accused. So just that night, you've got two locations going from and he's going to, and both of them are staffed by monks who've been credibly accused of misconduct. And I would bet most everything that I have that neither of those two monks were appropriately interrogated by the police.
And we know a lot of this, just once again for the listeners and the record, is because we know a lot of these missteps in the Jacob Wetterling case because a recent episode of the new show In the Dark that is covering all of that. In the second episode, they talk about how the police basically fumbled the investigation from the day it happened. And the Jacob Wetterling case could have been solved in 1989, possibly.
Well, worse than that, it could have been prevented. And
right,
that's something we look at in the Joshua Guimon case. If you're going to staff a student housing complex with and the person that's going to oversee it is a credibly accused monk, and you're going to staff another student housing complex with another monk who is credibly accused, you run the risk of missteps and additional misconduct. And I'm not saying that either of these two men took Joshua that night or did something that led to his disappearance, but I'm also saying that we don't know what their story was that night. And what's frustrated me the most about the law enforcement in that community and in that area is the lack of oversight and the lack of seriousness paid to the horrendous acts of misconduct that have taken place there over the last several decades. And when something like Joshua occurs, when Josh disappears in 2002, to not look at the history of St. John's and say, we might have an issue here that's bigger than just a student walking from point A to point B and he disappears. If you understand the history and you respect the history, you have to look at who had access to him that night. And two of the people that had access to him because of their jobs are credibly accused monks. They had to have been looked at. Don't believe they were. We don't know their story. we don't know the truth.
Being that you've been covering this for so long, since obviously since the early 90s, and have been trying to, you know, get all of this stuff on the record so more people know about St. John's University, do you remember where you were in 2002 when you heard about this disappearance? And what did you think happened? At the time, not necessarily now, but at the time, what was your knee-jerk reaction? Do you remember it?
I do. And I actually spoke with one of the law enforcement, a deputy for the Stearns County Sheriff, and I asked him, and I asked, what do you think happened? And he said, you know, he made me answer first. He said, what do you think happened? And I said, I think one of the monks probably was drinking. There's a long history of alcohol abuse documented in an incredible letter, article that was written in 1981. We can get back to that, but there was there's a long history of alcohol on campus by the monks. Mm. And I suggested that one of the monks had too much to drink that night, probably, or could have hit Joshua with one of the vehicles, the Abbey's fleet of vehicles. And because of the long history of misconduct on campus, they could not afford black mark against them.
Mm-hmm.
And the decision was made to cover it up, as they've covered up so many other crimes so easily on campus.
Especially given that a month before that, they had said it's a whole new St. John's University.
And they were lauded in the papers, the TV, for doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And this abbot, the leader, the monastery had taken this really a leadership, strong leadership position regarding sexual abuse, and was made to look like a saint almost. And they just couldn't handle bad publicity anymore. Yeah. And so it was easier in my mind to cover up. So that was my first thought.
Mm-hmm.
To this day. And what we just spoke about, where he had one left a building that was being overseen by one perpetrator monk, was heading to another building that was overseen by a second perpetrator monk. I don't believe that my story is regarding the possibility that we two men might have had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
My theory that a monk who was drinking could have hit him with a vehicle, my theory still works, because both of those men have drinking problems. So,
mm-hmm. And everyone should know, and I would urge you all who are listening to this to check out, obviously if you don't live in the area of Collegeville, but if you can check it out on Google Maps, you know, it's a little bit of a windy walk from one of those buildings to the other one. You have to go out around that lake and go across that bridge and go right along that road that leads right into the center of campus. And you could see on a late Saturday night, if it's dark, somebody who's been drinking a little bit could easily hit a pedestrian, you know, to me. You know, it's amazing, sure. Amazing to me that after all these years that they haven't built like a walking bridge across that lake or something, being that you have to go so far around, you know, to get to campus if you're at one of those other dorms.
It certainly wasn't then, and being it was dark, and you know, it's, yeah. You know, we don't know what Josh was wearing. We don't know if he even, you know, we don't know what happened to him. So we don't even know if he made it to the bridge.
Right.
But certainly, on that campus, there are plenty of roads that use better sidewalks, especially at that time, and better lighting. And a lot of those improvements have been made.
Yeah.
But you know, the theory of Joshua being hit by a car and having that crime covered up, that's a theory.
It's just a theory. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's one of many, and it's one that, you know, I would love to rule it out, but I'd love to rule everything out. I think we've spent 14 years speculating, and the speculation has to end. But I think in order, and what we've, when I met with a member of Joshua's family this past weekend, what we agreed to was that the speculation has to end. Mm-hmm. One way to end the speculation is to actually put the theories out there. So Joshua's website will soon be updated to include the theories as to what could have happened to him, so that somebody who has information about this case will Google his name, look at the theories, and say, hey, either theory 7 is what happened, and I feel comfortable enough now to come forward because somebody's already thought of it. Or they'll look at the 9 theories and they'll say, yeah, but you didn't think about theory 10, and this is what really happened. We're hoping that by putting the theories out there, we can... they're all speculation, but mm-hmm. we want to document the speculation so that we can end the speculation. Because the thing that I despise the most and has wasted so much of my time over the years is just idle mm-hmm. speculation that goes nowhere. Right. And so, you know, when I agreed to talk with you, I do want to put out there a few of these theories, because it's important for people to realize that we really don't know what happened. We do know that Josh was interested in sexual abuse on campus. We do know that he sought justice. We know that he was a fair kid, and he was very well liked and respected. We know that he had friends. We know that he liked to drink, that he liked to smoke cigars, and that he liked to have a blast, and sometimes did it in excess.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a loyal friend, and he cared about other people, and he had career aspirations. You know, he wanted to do something with his life. And that was stopped in November of 2002. And there are a lot of people who care about this story and care about finding an answer so that, you know, his legacy, you know, it could be properly documented.
You mentioned meeting his parents this past weekend. And by the way, we are doing this interview on September 21st. But this past weekend, you met them. How are they doing? It's been 14 years. I know, you know, being that I've talked to parents recently of lost children to disappearances. How are the Guimons doing these days?
So this past weekend, I met with Grandpa Bob Guimon, and I had the opportunity over the last 14 years to have many conversations with him and meet in person with him on many occasions. And he's a fantastic man, and he's really taken this, the disappearance of his grandson, as a personal mission. He wants to find Joshua, obviously. And he would like to do it, you know, he's getting up there in age, and as is his wife and other members of the family, and they just want some answers.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened this past weekend, we actually decided to get together because of the recent exposure that the law enforcement in Stearns County has received, and wanted to really see what we could do to put the spotlight back on Joshua's case and perhaps a spotlight on the environment at St. John's and put the spotlight on law enforcement and really look at what everybody can do. What can we do as people concerned about Joshua's disappearance? What can we do as far as that relates to sexual abuse and other misconduct on campus? And what can we do to push the law enforcement to do the right thing, to assist with this case. As far as how are they doing, mm-hmm. you know, you lost your buddy 14 years ago,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
Parts of the family believe he's still alive, or I should say members of the family, some members of the family believe that Josh is still alive. It's amazing what time can do. I mean, when you don't have answers, you're willing to turn to different resources to find those answers, whether it be psychics or ESP or, you know, early on and even more recently, I've heard about, you know, dowsing. dowsing rods and magnets and answers which come from things that, you know, normally we don't find answers about missing kids using these techniques.
No.
But when a family has spent so long and has had so few answers, I mean, no answers at all. He leaves point A and he doesn't show up at point B, and there's nothing in between to say this might have happened.
Yeah.
And so they hope, you know, now I just don't have my Wetterling quote here, but, you know, it's like Patty Wetterling said recently, you know, she said, for us, Jake was alive until we found him.
Yeah.
And the Gimons have to be, certainly are thinking the same thing. I mean, the hope is there. They want him to be alive, but as time passes and no contact is made, certainly the worst case is crossing their mind. And if a psychic or a similar technique says that he's still alive and can give them hope, you know, they probably are going to listen to that.
Yeah. You know, this reminds me so much of my conversation that I had with Kelly Murphy, the mother of Jason Tolkowski, who, of course, started Project Jason. She appeared on a recent episode of my show. And in her son's case, it's very much the same thing, that he was here 1 second, was walking from his house to the local high school to get a ride, and somewhere in between, he just disappeared. And his was in broad daylight on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, with no, you know, sexual abuse claims all around in that area or anything like that. So I totally hear what you're saying, I understand what the family's saying as well.
But then when you add up everything that was happening at the time or has happened in those locations, and we know that St. John's has a long, dark, I wanted to say rich, history of sexual abuse on campus. It has been home to dozens and dozens of pedophile and sexual deviants. Mm-hmm. We don't know which one of those, how many of them were on campus that night, or Josh might have run into previously. We know that in the area there has been cult activity. We know in the area there have been rings of pedophiles. We know in the area that there have been disappearances, you know, until recently unsolved.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you've got your best cases of why he might have disappeared and how, and you have your worst cases. And sadly, because it happened on the campus of St. John's University, home to the St. John's Monastery, you know, the likelihood that it was something toward the evil side, you know, rather than the innocent mistake side, is more likely. And that's just based on the history of the place.
Yeah.
But we don't know. You know, in the end, we don't know. And that's the sad part for the family, and that's a sad part for his friends. You know, hopefully, someday they'll have an answer. They'll have some closure. And hopefully, you know, the people who covered it up, the people who perpetrated his disappearance and who helped him get away with it, will be held accountable.
Right. Right. Let's talk about your website, behindthepinecurtain.com. How long has that been around, and when you started it, what was the motivation? Obviously, you've been dealing with this since your abuse in the early 1980s and then coming forward in 1990, 91. But how long has the website been around, and what was the final motivator to get it started?
It was 2002 when I actually created the website. At that point, it was called the Abuse Disclosure Project. And I was just tired of two things. I was exhausted from listening to the stories of victims, number one.
Mm-hmm.
But I was tired of the attention that wasn't being paid to the problem at St. John's. And so I created the website in an effort to lead people, to direct them to this resource. When they called me or they searched the internet, they would find it. I knew that people were seeking answers, and they had no place to turn. I mean, they could call me if they knew me and they, you know, could research it in one way or the other and somehow come up with my name. But I had spoken with enough people, and enough people had contacted me that I knew that a resource was necessary. And so I put together a website of, I think at that point it was 8 or 9 perpetrators. And I was aware way back in the early 90s of these 8 perpetrators and of well over 40 victims. And I think at that point in the early 2000s, I was still dealing with that about the same number, 8, 9 perpetrators, 40 or 50 victims. And I had no idea it was going to take off and become almost 100 perpetrators and well over 300 victims. But, you know, that's the website was there as a resource for people who needed answers and who late at night had just needed somebody to talk to, or they just needed something to see that validated their experience. And that's the number one word that I tend to use when talking about sexual abuse is validation. Victims many times don't need a lawsuit, don't need a settlement, don't need counseling. They simply need validation, knowing that what happened to them did actually happen, that it happened to others, that they're not alone, they didn't bring it on themselves. And a lot of times that's all they need. And that's all I wanted to provide was just a validation for those people who needed it.
Mm-hmm.
So as time went on, people would come to the website and they'd tell me their story, send me a message, give me a call, ask that I call them. And the list got bigger and the number of victims increased. And it really became something that, you know, it's a sad project. You know, every time you add a perpetrator's name, every time you speak to just another victim or to a victim's family member, you know, it's amazing the stories that I've heard. I'm thinking of a family. They have 3 boys in the family. They actually have more family members, but I don't want to give anything away here.
Mm-hmm,
but
I understand.
Talk about these 3 boys. Well, 2 of the boys, I'll go back to the third boy. A kid calls me up. Well, I call him a kid because in a lot of ways he's still a kid because he hasn't dealt with his abuse. And because of that, he's in a place in his life where he hasn't grown up past the age of his abuse. And that happens to a lot of people. So I say, and this kid calls up and he says, you know, I had this incident with this priest and I don't know what to do. So we talk about it for a while and I listen to him and he gives me the name of the priest and he says, listen, I'd love to come forward and tell my story. I'd like to do it, but I can't use my name because I come from this family. I say, that's fine. You don't have to use your name. He says, well, I'm concerned because I've got these brothers and I'm just concerned about them. And I don't know if the concern was that something happened to them. I think he suggested to me that something might have happened, but he was worried about going through the whole process. He wanted to be, as many people do, he wanted to be anonymous. And I said, certainly whether you come talk to me or you go see an attorney or you talk to a therapist, whatever you do, you know, your confidentiality is part of the puzzle. That's assured if you need that to happen. And so I said, you know, feel comfortable doing whatever you want to do. And he said that, you know, he was worried about that. And he thought, you know what, I can't go forward. In the end, he said, I can't go forward with this because I'm just afraid that my name will be made public. But what I couldn't tell him was that his brothers had already gone through the process.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Both of those brothers had already settled claims against the Abbey.
Oh, my gosh.
And here he was, what a story. Third brother in the family. And he couldn't come forward and never did come forward because he didn't want his name to get out there. And I couldn't tell him anything.
No.
I just had to say, you know, that's just... whenever you're ready to talk, I'm willing to talk. I said, there are other resources out there. And you know, he said, you know, maybe call me back sometime. I haven't spoken to him since, but, you know, it's no different from a family. There's a family in the area, and I've spoken with 4 members of the family. None of the 4 know that the other 3 have spoken with me. All 4 were abused by the same priest. None of the 4 knows each other has been abused. And stories like that that talk to, speak to. I mean, here's an interesting piece to this puzzle. This may help you understand sexual abuse better.
Mm-hmm.
The number one reason I feel why people don't report sexual abuse and come forward is because they're afraid of shaming their parents. Oh, I'm going to wait till my parents die, and then I'll do something about it. Oh, it would break my mother's heart. Oh, my parents are so Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Children do not want to embarrass or shame their parents. They will take on all the crap that comes along with being a victim and moving toward being a survivor. But if it means that their parents will be shamed or embarrassed, they won't do it. And because of it, they're suffering from issues with alcohol, with drugs, marital issues, problems with their jobs, and in some cases, sexual abuse of their own doing. They've grown up with problems with sexuality because they didn't deal with their own sexuality appropriately, or they were taught about sexuality from the wrong person. And as a result, they've got on this path that is dysfunctional in all those aspects of life. And one of the things that I've tried to do with my website and my advocacy is to say that, you know, we need to break these cycles for all of those five reasons. If we can keep somebody from drinking or from doing drugs, or we can help their marriage, or we can help them be more peaceful in their job, and by heaven's sakes, if we can keep them from acting inappropriately with another person, minor or otherwise, then we need to do that. So that's the root of what I do, is I try to take people off of this cycle of dysfunction that they're on, and to see that there's another way. And only by providing them with validation for their own stories, and to let them know that they're not alone, and to let them know that the truth is it's such a gift. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and once we find out the truth, and the truth about what happened to Josh is more likely to be told if we know the truth about St. John's. But the truth about St. John's is so buried and is so far from the surface. And if that's what's required in order to bring Josh back or to find out what happened to him, we'll never know what happened to him.
No.
It's only once St. John's decides that it's time to tell the truth, to come with forward, full disclosure. It's only then that Josh and other bodies, in quotes, that have been buried, you know, that we find out what happens to them.
What is the most recent graduate of St. John's that has approached you about being abused?
It was a gentleman who graduated from St. John's University this past spring. He was the recipient of sexual harassment / misconduct during his freshman year. He reported it. It went up the chain. His perpetrator was pulled and was retrained and was placed back in the dorm. And my understanding is works there again this year. So that is the most recent episode of misconduct, of sexual harassment, or, you know, things that are inappropriate on campus. Before then, one of the priests, Nathaniel McDonald, acted inappropriate. This is the gentleman, by the way, that had confessed to having over 200 sexual encounters, many of them overseas, and many of them with underage kids who wore numbers so that he could pick them out of a lineup and say, I'd like that one today.
Oh my.
And he was inappropriate, touched the crotch area, and played with the zipper of one of the employees at St. John's a couple of years ago. And as a result, he was shipped off campus to Missouri, and to a place in, I believe it was Dittmer, Missouri, to a facility that is nicknamed Club Ped, because that's where the worst of the Catholic pedophile priests go. And served some time there, and then they sent him to a nursing home in northern Minnesota, which I had the opportunity to visit just after he left, and they said, oh, he's a great man. We enjoyed having him here. And I said, well, were you aware that he is a multiple accused perpetrator of sexual abuse against minors? And the lady's jaw dropped.
Oh,
and
she's like,
I had no idea. I'm not sure where he is now. I've heard he's back on campus. I hope that's not the case. But there are many perpetrators, many credibly accused men, perpetrators of sexual misconduct against minors and others, who are on campus right now, walking, interacting with students. St. John's won't tell you their names. They won't provide pictures. We don't know who they are. I know who they are. But the general public, general population, the kids who are visiting for soccer camp, kids who are there for the football games, kids who are there for the choir, people who are in the seats at church, they don't know who these men are. And they're allowed to take vehicles, drive to local St. Cloud establishments, do their shopping, and come home. The oversight is poor at best, and the community should be frightened. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a question of if it will happen again, it's a question of when. They will reoffend. These are serious sexual perpetrators.
So the preponderance of the evidence would say that probably right as we're talking, something's going on at St. John's University right now.
Well, I say yes, but I qualify by saying this. If you're on campus, your son or daughter is on campus now, and more likely your son or daughter is going to be the victim here. But if they're at the cafeteria right now, or in the locker room at the gym, or walking campus looking at the leaves turning, there's a monk nearby, more likely than not, in one of those places. And even if your son isn't being fondled right now, he's still being looked at inappropriately by one of these gentlemen who has been charged with being a good community member and took vows as part of their priesthood to be a good man, and instead they're undressing your son, and that's inappropriate. So is a child, is a student, is somebody being victimized at St. John's right now? Yeah, they are. But you know, I would hope that it's happening on the sidewalk, and that it's something that doesn't involve, you know, the inappropriate touching or the grooming, or that they're not getting them, you know, providing them with alcohol so that they can, you know, compromise them later. I can tell you this. Is somebody on campus right now being groomed?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Will that grooming result in misconduct? I hope not. I can't say definitely not. I hope not. But are they being groomed? I'm going to say 100% yes, because what these men do is groom. That is their MO. That is their way of life. And that's what they do. They groom. They groom all day long. Was Joshua Guimon being groomed? Yeah, he was. Was his groomer serious about doing something? Probably. Did his groomer have the opportunity? We'll never know. But certainly, because that's what these guys do, is groom. That's their day. Their day is, who can I groom? Whether it be somebody in their own monastic community, you know, or a student, or the son or daughter of one of their friends. Yeah, they're groomers. That's what they do. So that's an important thing to think about, too. That's what these guys do. And it's just, you know, the guy who got me back in the 80s, he was grooming at least three. My two best friends, he was grooming them. And he probably had, well, he had a student body of, you know, several dozen kids to groom. And then they narrow it down. And at some point it becomes, who's the vulnerable kid that I can now take advantage of? I spent all of this time grooming these dozens or these dozen or this half dozen, and they've narrowed it down, and then they're just looking for opportunity. The grooming is going on. The grooming is there. Now they're just waiting for opportunity. They're waiting for somebody to be vulnerable, and when they're vulnerable, there's an opportunity. They've been properly groomed. They will strike again. It's just a matter of time.
Patrick Marker, tell everyone how they could find you, how to contact you, your information, anything you want to put out there before we sign off on this interview for today.
Well, the website that I started back in 2002 is now called Behind the Pine Curtain. It's meant to be a resource for victims. I simply try to validate their stories, try to tell the stories that St. John's doesn't want the public to hear, whether it be sexual abuse or elder abuse, their fundraising issues, the fact that their beloved coach John Gilardi knew about sexual abuse back in the 50s and 60s, and that like him and other faculty members just didn't do enough or anything about it. And because of that, the entire community has been affected. The entire community needs to be healed. But the only way that healing takes place is if we get to the truth. And I've merely tried to provide with the website a starting point for that truth. So Behind the Pine Curtain is where people should go. Mm-hmm. I look forward to any input and feedback and help that anybody wants to provide. It's been a real honor to speak with victims and their families and to have that trust put in me so that these people can be relieved of their own stories and guilt and shame. And really, it's just an opportunity for me to give back. And I appreciate the ability to do so.
Do you have email? Is that the only thing you're prepared to give out at this time?
No. There's a contact page on the website.
Okay, great.
My phone number's on there. I think my email address is on there, and there's certainly a contact page. They can send me a message anytime.
Great. So, Patrick, thank you for coming forward, and thank you for everything that you've done since to help all of these victims and their families. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet.
Thanks for being on Unfound.
I hope you can now see why I said before the interview started that I was just going to allow Patrick to tell his own story. Of course, this goes back to the beginning of the interview where he talked about his own abuse on the St. John's campus going back to the early 80s. Patrick Marker is the kind of person who I try to get for you for this show. Once again, as I've told you, I'm just a reporter. It's a guy like Patrick who is out there, who is researching this stuff. He's uncovering information that the school is trying to cover up to the point where he got kicked off the campus of the school that he graduated from. These are the kinds of people that I like to bring to you. I guess another good example would be Lee Clifton and my interview I did with her for the disappearance of Kelly Rothwell. These are the types of people doing the real work out there. And they should be noticed for what they're doing because they are providing a huge public service. And this show is just a way for them to get their message out. Now, as to what Patrick and I talked about, covered a lot of ground in that interview. Just some highlights and maybe a couple points that weren't brought up. First, you should know that on some sites, Joshua's disappearance has tried to be connected to some other disappearances on campuses where young men got drunk, fell into the water, and drowned. And in fact, I guess about 8 years ago, there was this whole thing called the Smiley Face Killers. Do you remember that? It's a theory that I dismissed at the time, and I continue to dismiss it. Not just the theory of the Smiley Face Killers, but the idea that Josh's disappearance was connected to these other young men in the Wisconsin, Minnesota area who fell into a body of water and drowned. I don't think his disappearance has anything to do with any of theirs. There's no proof that Joshua was so drunk that he would have fallen into a body of water and drowned. And it should be noted that those bodies of water near the campus and on campus were searched first and foremost. That has to be remembered. However, in thinking about Josh's case, I am reminded of a couple other cases that I know of that might be relevant to Josh's disappearance that have nothing to do with the sex abuse scandal that has gone on the St. John's University campus for 50 years. I think of the story of Kelly Nash. Do you know this story? Happened in 2015, early 2015, January 5th, as a matter of fact. Kelly Nash was a young man, seemingly had everything to live for, working in family's construction company, no money worries, seemed to be a pretty good guy. Back on January 5th of 2015, he decided to stay up late while his girlfriend went to bed. Next day, he was gone. A few days later, he was found in a lake a few miles away with a bullet wound, and he was dead. His truck was still at his house. Police started to investigate and found that they found a video shot taken from a convenience store that showed a lonely man walking down the street, down the road in the middle of the night, about the time that would have been that Kelly Nash could have conceivably left his house and walked down to that lake. Now, as you can imagine, there are some conspiracy theories regarding all of this. And maybe his girlfriend had something to do with it. Maybe he caught a couple intruders outside and they murdered him. And it's not him walking in that video because you can't really see the face of the individual on that street that night. But Kelly Nash's story is not the only one where people who seemingly have everything to live for suddenly walk away. And in fact, if you go to any missing person's site where it's just case after case after case, you'll find that that is more common than you'd realize. So it's possible that that happened in Joshua's case. Possible. We have to keep that theory open. Another possibility, and I think of the case of Morgan Harrington, even though she was a young woman, but she was on a college campus, went to a Metallica concert, found herself outside of the venue, couldn't get back in. She told her friends, I'll figure something out. She ended up being picked up by a man who had a violent history, ended up killing her, and he was caught a few years later. He had been connected to another rape in another city, and then his DNA was connected to Morgan Harrington. In fact, he was connected to another disappearance as well. So people getting into the wrong car with the wrong person on college campuses happen. That's probably another phenomenon that we don't realize happens as much as it does. So we have to be open to that. Although the difference between Joshua's case and Morgan's case is that Morgan was on the campus of Virginia Tech in a major city in Virginia, whereas Joshua was on a very small campus in a much smaller city. We also have to consider that maybe Joshua met with foul play on the St. John's campus completely by accident, and that was talked about during the interview with Patrick Marker, that he might have been hit by a car. And what I would urge you to do is to go to Google Maps and go to Street View and cruise around the St. John's campus as much as you can using that. And you'll be able to go step by step the path that Joshua would have taken. And as I said in the interview, I bet that's a pretty dark walk at night. And it'd probably be very easily if Josh was walking on the street, the car comes up, hits him. Maybe it is somebody from the university. Maybe it's not. Somebody who might want to cover that up. So there's several possibilities in addition to the idea that Joshua was doing research into what had gone on at St. John's for all those decades, and then somebody wanted him not to do that anymore. But as is always the case, I leave that up to you. Maybe you have a theory that is outside anything that was discussed on this show. If so, I'd love to hear about it. This is a case, Joshua's case, is one that I've known about for a long time, but only more recently did I hear about the abuse that went on the campus where he disappeared. And it certainly adds a disturbing element to the entire story. But once again, if you have any information, please contact the Stearns County Sheriff's Department. Thank you for listening. You can find me on Twitter at Unfound Podcast. Please subscribe at Podomatic and iTunes. I'm Ed Denzel, and this has been Unfound.